Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Welcome to the first Second Captains Football podcast of a new month. And if you thought last month gave us a fair bit of off-the-field drama to keep us going, May is already giving April a run for its money after a group of Man United fans stormed Old Trafford yesterday, protesting against the club's owners, resulting in the match against Liverpool, the biggest, if oftentimes most boring fixture on the English football calendar, having to be postponed. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
Hi, Kieran.
Best Manchester United-Liverpool match day of the last 5 or 6 years, Owen?
It was hard to take your eyes off it, that's for sure. That's the story that's going to dominate today.
Best, I'd imagine best since the three-all draw. Since the Razor Ruddock three-all draw.
It's going to rumble into the... What does Razor Ruddock make of what's going on at the moment? We should find that out. I'd imagine this is going to rumble into the World Service during the week. We may not be talking three football pods in a row territory, but between this and the second legs of the Champions League semi-finals, all of our members will have their fill of football coverage. Also, tomorrow we'll reflect on Leinster's elimination from the Heineken Cup at the hands of La Rochelle. And as always, we'd love to have any of you Monday-only heads become World Service members. The details are on secondcaptains.com. In the meantime, we're treating you non-members to something a little bit special later on today. Our chat with Oisin McConville and Andrew Trimble on Northern Ireland, which has already been played out on the World Service. It's a fascinating insight into their own backgrounds, into segregation that still exists in the North, how things can potentially move forward. The two guys were absolutely amazing talking about all of that. We thought it was the type of chat, in fact some of our members also made the point, it's the type of chat we should make available to everybody, you know, the way we like to do this occasionally. And why not do it today? It's a day that Northern Ireland celebrates its 100th birthday. I mean, it's not an occasion that everybody in Northern Ireland would use the term celebrate to describe. I'm aware of that. But listen, the football podcast is not the time to get into those thorny issues. We do a lot of that.
It's going to get a letter from the Queen on.
Yeah, yeah. So that's going to be available to all later today. Hope you enjoy that. And by the way, whether you're a member or not, we are looking for all you guys to get voting. Our podcast series, Where is George Gibney, has been nominated for a number of prestigious and international awards of late, one of which, the Webbies, is open to a public vote. Its original music score and sound design are the categories in question that we're nominated for there in the Webbies. The last we heard, Murph, we had our noses in front in the early running. How's it going?
We have fallen behind to a podcast called California Love. We have 24% of the vote. They have 25% of the vote. And there's a third challenger also, Radio Rental, on 23% of the vote. But, I mean, the funny thing is, Owen, this isn't even about us anymore. This is about Ireland as a nation. Are we going to lay down and die now when we've come so far? Or do we take our inspiration from John Tracy against Steve Ovett at Crystal Palace in the 5,000 metres in 1980? Do we allow our well-heeled opponents glide imperiously to victory? Or is there a chance that we can make a glorious swan dive at the last second to pip our international challengers? Are you a mudlark or are you a quitter? That is the question I pose to you, our listener, today. Mudlark or quitter?
Get voting, everyone. Nicely done, Murph. We've shared the link on social media and on today's page on secondcaptains.com. So hopefully you guys will get the job. Listen, I can't improve on Murph's big sale there. Just win a Webby for Second Captains first.
No, not even for us. For your country, Owen. For your country.
For yourself, yeah. Before I let you loose, Ken, on events at Old Trafford yesterday, can we all please spare a thought for Sky Sports presenter Dave Jones, who I felt felt had a tough gig yesterday. He's a very good presenter. He was up against a couple of forces conspiring against him. One was Gary Neville. I think we might come back to the Neville-Jones dynamic. Secondly, though, there was the lack of anything much going on. I know that sounds ridiculous when we've just said how incredible it was to watch. And, you know, there was the initial excitement about the protest. There was the storming of the pitch. But then it's the reality of, okay, we're starting to repeat ourselves a little bit now. This is dragging on quite a lot. And there's still no bloody news about whether or not the match is going to happen.
If you're just joining us, we still don't have any update on a kickoff time here at Old Trafford. Manchester United due to be taking on Liverpool. It was supposed to be a 4:30 start, but no news yet of either team actually leaving their respective team hotels, despite the vicinity being cleared here by police over the last half an hour or so. We don't know yet when we'll be able to bring you any news of a kick-off time, but do stay with us because...
Because what, Dave? What's after the break?
We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk some football. How about that? We've got Graeme Souness here, we've got Roy Keane, we've got Micah Richards, we've got Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher. How are these two teams going to get themselves to the top of the Premier League next season? Do stay with us.
And that's what they were talking about when the news eventually broke. Gary Neville was pitch side banging on about whether or not Dean Henderson should be Man United's number one goalkeeper when suddenly, look, we've all been in these chats, guys. You know you're filling. You've got to fill. I mean, somebody, you can't just sit there and do nothing. So you're talking about Dean Henderson and whether or not he should be the United number one goalkeeper when suddenly, finally, the news comes through. Dave Jones was given something to work with. The big story broke, but even at that, Neville and Carragher and Jeff Shreves in the background stole his thunder.
Quite well since he's come in, and I think he's handled big matches. It looks like he's got the confidence to be able and temperament to be able to play for Manchester United. But the big test is next year, and I think he deserves that chance.
Come on, Jamie.
I think the game might be off.
We're just being told the game's off.
Yes, Chef?
Yeah, just hearing this now. We've got a statement from Manchester United as well. That's just released the following statement, following discussion.
So, yeah, I felt for Dave Jones. Police, tough gig yesterday, but he's a top presenter. And he'll dust himself down, I'm sure. Let's please report on yesterday's events, please.
I did think he was struggling a little bit, Owen. I mean, there was one point at which he said, well, you know, the players continue to be delayed, you know, at this point, you know, what will that mean? Further pre-match meals or...
I was quite interested in the pre-match meal thing. I was quite... Because Roy Keane said, oh, sure, they can just basically redo the whole pre-match routine and have another load of food. But like, then you're obviously putting the match back by a number of hours at that point. I was quite interested in that. I was in the nutritional elements to yesterday.
Good work, Owen. You may have been an audience of one there, but nevertheless.
It just, I mean, they started talking about like who United
we've got Roy
sign.
Keane in the Old Trafford kitchen showing us what he would do in a situation like this.
Jaffa cakes.
But it's like, who should Man United sign? Let's talk about that now. And it just seemed as though like, you know, here we are sort of on the Titanic and let's play a game of patience, everyone. You know, no, patience is a one-man game. You know, let's just play a nice little game of cards while you know, all this erupts around us. It just sort of seems so weirdly out of place. Although, you know.
And also there was an element of, you know, Glazer's out, but let's get someone in quickly. Who can buy Harry Kane for Manchester United as well. You know, it's like... like
the whole thing. Like, I mean, you know, I mean, Neville obviously was having an incredible time. Like, I mean, he has sort of... He has become... he's transcended his old pundit persona, you know? We don't see so much of the screen, the touch screen. You know, it's a bit more like just straight into the camera rants.
Rubbish.
And it's more of a Jamie Redknapp thing, the touchscreen now, really, isn't it?
But I mean, do you remember when he did the bit with Joe Malloy? He did the bit with Joe Malloy, which is on YouTube. Joe and Nathan at the Bord Gáis Theatre, and then he tweeted afterwards something about how the problem is presenters these days think they can butt in and say stuff. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And And there was just a moment with poor old Dave Jones. Let's just play it. The problem is that you can't see Gary Neville when he says this. You can't see the roll of the eyes that he does when Dave comes interjecting. But just listen to how this went.
They tried to walk away and create a closed shop league that would have basically created a famine in this country for every other football club.
Gary, what are you saying here? Are you saying that all fans should try and get matches called off?
Dave, let me finish. Dave, this is not a time to interject and start it. They tried to create a famine 2 weeks ago.
So, do you think Lennon, when he was delivering an impassioned speech to the masses, had to put up with some little guy in a suit, trying to butt in with little objections? Like, Lenin is there like, we stand for organized terror. Terror is an absolute necessity in times of revolution. And suddenly little Dave Otchka is there going, no, but are you sure it's an absolute necessity? Wouldn't it be better if we could get somewhere, without terror? No, Lennon did not have to put up with that. You don't see Big Jim Larkin, with those big hands of his in the air, suddenly having to look over his shoulder. What, Dave? What's that? Although I do feel sorry for Dave, because if you listen to the little point Dave was trying to get in there, it was, is it really that good if the matches all get cancelled, Gary? Which I feel is a point that Sky, who Dave works for, now obviously Gary Neville works for as well, although he's a man with many fingers and many pies.
He works for the people.
He works,
and that's obvious.
He works for the people, and thank God he's a man of independent means as well. So he does have the ability to, perhaps he's got a certain freedom that many of the sort of wage drones out there don't necessarily have to really express what is within them. But like, I did feel a bit sorry for Dave, because we only see him being sort of dismissed rudely by Gary Neville on television. We don't get to see the pressure that's coming from the other side. We don't hear about what Dave is hearing from the guys at Sky. He might be like, yeah, Dave, now again, I'm hypothesizing here, but I wouldn't be surprised if somebody had maybe suggested to Dave, we're delighted with how the program is going. Lots of people are tuning in. We're getting great response. At the same time, we do feel as though maybe it would the conversation would benefit from somebody at some point suggesting that maybe the matches should go ahead, given that we're paying like what, £11 million per match, and it is sort of like the core of our business model is showing this football, which apparently isn't going to happen. So if you maybe could just venture that opinion at some point. And Dave did it a couple of times. It wasn't just that.
Oh, he did it on a number of occasions. And there was also the point that you obviously we're about this, and we don't know what producers were saying to him and how it necessarily worked. But we can have a pretty good guess, as you say there. And also a giveaway is how often it would happen where he would come back later on, like the conversation would have moved on, and then a while later he'd come back to ask Neville for the umpteenth time. Gary, just to clarify, of course, you don't think it's right. I mean, we can't condone breaking the law, trespassing, and so on. That's often an indication that either Dave Jones has decided himself, hang on, I need to go back to that, or somebody's got in his ear and say, you got to go back there. And listen, I totally empathize with him. That's what I'm saying. I've been in this situation. You have to come across as sometimes the stick in the mud, The boring, straight presenter is the role you got to play when there's so much to... so much more to it than that.
Well, of course, Dave Jones has been burned before doing that with his remember in December 2019 it was, when Neville was talking about racism in the game, and he made a connection between that was at the time, if you remember, when wasn't it the time when Raheem Sterling, was that when Raheem Sterling had come out, had Sterling been abused at Chelsea? Was that the right time, or am I thinking of 2018? But
not sure.
It was coming up to the British election, but that was December 2019, and Neville had made some comment about racism and had connected it to Boris Johnson and his rhetoric. And at the end of whatever Neville had said, Jones then interjected something very much, of course we have to state that Gary's opinions and not necessarily the views of Sky Sports. One of those type of disclaimer interjections. And Neville was like, what, you don't agree with me, Dave? And he's like, oh, well, I didn't expect you to say that to me now, and now I'm floundering. And then he got absolutely destroyed on social media for this, for his... it just goes to show how the scheme is that broadcasters employ or have been sort of trained in to deal with like controversial discussions, and of course we must reiterate the need for balance, are actually kind of increasingly not working in this very much more heightened sort of atmosphere that they now have to work in. You know what I mean? Like so in that case it was, or I think Jones ended up apologizing for it. In this case, it's a bit more like, say there was a range of objections that he had. And I don't mean to just make this whole thing a discussion of like, you know, another program. But this was, this unfortunately how we had to experience these events. And Jones was saying, he said, we don't want to see fans storming stadiums, Gary, do we? And at that point, Neville was like, okay, we don't want that. I mean, because we'd seen the fans literally come in, like Shreves was talking to Carragher, and the fans suddenly arrived into the stadium. You could see them like pouring in from the far corner, and Carragher went really quiet. Like he started his eyes darting around like a little field mouse, you know, as he tried to establish just exactly what the situation was that was developing here, you know. I mean, he obviously spoke passionately in favor of what the fans were doing, but at that point he looked like he just wanted to establish what exactly is happening here. There's an element of chaos has broken into the stadium here and is fanning out across the pitch. I'm not quite sure what's about to happen here. But Jones was saying, you know, we don't want this storming of stadiums. That, I mean, it's from Sky's point of view, obviously matches not happening is not good. But the other point then he made was like, he managed to get Neville to agree with that. I mean, Neville still works for Sky. He is for now the Sky pundit, and he did, okay, yeah, I'm not sure about storming stadiums. But he then said, because there was some footage of like fans sort of throwing cameras down, breaking stuff up, you know, and obviously glass doors had been broken down and so on and so forth. And he said something like, you know, if a minority of fans, you know, do you think maybe the majority of Manchester United fans out there, because clearly the majority of Manchester United fans were not involved in the protests yesterday. You know, there's lots of Man United fans of varying levels of commitment. And there was like, you know, a few thousand people maybe involved in the protests at Old Trafford. So obviously the majority of fans weren't there. Do you think the majority of Man United fans might sort of disapprove of, you know, of a minority breaking, you know, damaging property and doing things like this? And I thought, no, that's not as successful an objection. I don't really think anyone cares about a door getting broken at Old Trafford or any of these types of things.
We're Man fucking United!
You know, it's like, this is fundamentally, it's a dispute over property rights. You know, that's really what it is. It's like, do the Glazers have the right to just go, well, we own it, we can do whatever we want with it, or is it actually more complicated than that? Do these other people who the law says actually have no ownership whatsoever, this is a tax streamlined entity domiciled in Delaware or wherever it is, wherever Manchester United are based, the corporate entity that Manchester United is, that's what it is? Or is it actually something which all of these people also in a sense own and have a right to a say over? That's really what this is. And so if property is damaged in a much bigger dispute over property rights or what ownership really means, then I don't think anyone's too worried about that, really.
I get the sense I was reading Jonathan Liu, for example. He says the overwhelming reaction here is not exhilaration, but sadness. As tempting as it was to be swept up in the insurgent thrill, what really unfolded was an act of pure desperation, the last refuge of a group of men and women whose every last avenue had been closed to them. Fan power, alas, no, it was in many ways the ultimate expression of fan powerlessness. I don't know. It seemed powerful enough in that it had the immediate desired effect of getting the game called off. Whether or not, this is the big question of the center a lot of the chat yesterday, whether or not is going to make a blind bit of difference to the Glazers. Like, that's what we're going to find out over the next little while. I mean, if it was just that and that's it and then that's the end of the protest, then maybe not. But you got to assume that this is, as I think Roy Keane pointed out on a few occasions, is the start of something rather than the end of something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. Like, okay, so it was interesting to watch what happened yesterday, because there was this immediate parallel that like occurs to you when you see these images of the Capitol rally. Now, I don't mean to say to draw an equivalence between, you know, the protesters at the Capitol or whatever and, you know, the people who are at Old Trafford, but there was some similarity in form in it, at least when you saw these I saw this video of like United fans are just sort of surging through these barriers, and like these people in yellow jackets just kind of giving way, or like clearly hopelessly outnumbered and like just letting people through. You know, like there was no chance of sort of stopping this. So there was that thing of like this thing is there. It's actually lightly defended, or much more lightly defended. A lot of the defense of it is based on the fact that, well, no one's going to attack it. You know what I mean? It's not, you don't, it's just everybody knows not to sort of invade it.
Like, it's sacred. The pitch is a sacred place.
It's just the rules. We sort of don't do that. And suddenly people are doing it. It's like, oh, well, we actually don't have the capacity to stop that if a huge number of people suddenly decide to do it. But like, you know, people tend to think inside, tend to operate inside the sort of generally agreed upon rules, which are implicit all around us. Like the way the people, you know, the famous thing about the people in the Capitol walking through the marble halls, but like respecting the aisle that had been laid out by the rope either side. You know, it's just that they sort of, it didn't occur to them to walk outside it. So suddenly people had decided to do this, and there was this like chaotic thing was unfolding, which was quite similar. It's like, oh, here, what's the crowd doing? They're in this place. They should, you know, Shreve's going, we don't want to see this. And then it's that chaotic element. Like some people are throwing flares. Most people are just sort of running around. And there was like Jonathan Liu's piece was referring to this like kind of carnival-esque type of, like the people were clearly having a laugh.
Who said wrestling back our national game from the oligarchs and private equity funds couldn't also be a top day out with the lads? That's what he wrote.
Absolutely right. And you could totally see that, right, with the people at Old Trafford, just as you could, I think, with a lot of what was going on at the Capitol there, in the, you know, in this bigger but there's some sort of elements clearly in common there, like of a crowd that's like protesting against a perceived injustice. But there was also in this case, that's probably, in fairness, was the case of the Capitol as well. And I don't really want to talk too much more about that event, because it's a different subject and things will get confused. But there was also what was happening at the Lowry was actually the, and I think Mark Critchley was pointing this out. He was there.
Yeah, we're going to talk to Mark Critchley and Jonathan Wilson. Mark was around the Lowry in particular. He saw a lot of what was going on there.
Yeah, that was kind of the key pressure point, because the players were in there and couldn't come out, and so that protest, while it didn't have this kind of almost spontaneous or carnivalesque element of the Old Trafford thing, it actually was like, no, we know what we're doing here, and we're gonna be here until this game gets called off. You know what I mean? So it was like that was kind of an organized and disciplined protest, which achieved its aim. And I think it's very interesting that this thing, I mean, nothing like this has happened before. You know, I mean, when has this happened before? And like Souness was on TV going, I don't think this, the Glazers are business people. Souness was so interesting, I thought, in what he said about this, because it was so interesting, you know, unintentionally, because he sort of displayed, he was like a perfect specimen of this like fossilized consensus, which is completely wrong. Like, but he, you know, he was saying of the Glazers, these are business people. Like, he kept talking about them being business people as though that meant they were, you know, in some sort of super category. But he's like, you know, this won't affect their thinking one iota. I thought, one iota? Are you serious? Like, they've got the game called off. There's people marching around the stadium and around the centre of Manchester chanting a war song about wanting to cut you up from head to toe. Right? That's literally how we kill him, I don't know. Cut him up from head to toe. All I know is Glazer's gonna die. That's the song. Right? That's the song. There's the poster about Avi Glazer went to Epstein Island. This poster is being bandied about above the crowd. You know what I mean? These are not the sorts of things that like even the Glazer family is just brushing off, I imagine. You know, not, and then you've got the fact that the game didn't happen. What's going to happen now? Is this going to happen again? This is definitely affecting their thinking one iota or more, I would suggest. I mean, but just on what Souness was saying, I thought it was so interesting to see this guy who is like one of the top pundits, one of the most famous people in English football, one of the best known faces on English television, who for the last decade, I guess, since, but you know, he was a player, he was a manager, people, you know, criticize him as a manager, but he did win a lot of trophies. You know, he had a pretty good career in management compared to most managers. And then he's a pundit, so he's been sort of analyzing the game, and yet he was so clueless about what was actually going on at Manchester United. You know, in terms of the Glazer ownership, he said, like, they have put in collateral to buy this club. The collateral they put in was the club. They said it's a leveraged buyout. Like, they borrowed the money using the club as security. The club became liable for their debts, and they've been using the club ever since to pay back the loans they took out to buy the club, by which they've profited massively, both by paying themselves dividends, which of course Souness had no problem with. Their business people, that's what business people do. And in terms of capital appreciation, although maybe the capital hasn't appreciated as much as they thought, given that there's now all this uproar and no one's really sure what's going to happen next. But I just thought it was so interesting that Souness sort of evidently had no idea of these details. He didn't understand the details. He was unaware of them, because if he was unaware, he wouldn't have said what he said the way he said it. And yet seemed just to quite confidently assume that this must all somehow be in order. You know what I mean? Like, that this is just, well, of course, you know, the Glazers are business people. You don't get to buy Man United just by saying, I want to buy Man United. You have to put in collateral. You have to risk something. You know, these are business people. They've given successive managers fortunes to spend, he said, was another unbelievable thing that he said. They haven't given managers anything. The club the club makes money, which it then, the Glazers allow it to spend some of its own money on players. And this is characterized as they've given managers fortunes to spend. The club would have had that money anyway. Would have had much more money if it hadn't been for the Glazers.
It was interesting. Anyway. Just to pick up on that, I thought it was interesting the different tone he struck the night of the Liverpool Leeds game. Or was he was on TV the following night, actually, when it was all starting to come crashing down for the around the Chelsea match, the European Super League. And when he was talking about how the owners, the Liverpool owners, like, this could be the end for them. You know, they might not be welcome back in Anfield and all this kind of stuff. Which he didn't seem to, and he seemed to think that would be legitimate from a Liverpool point of view, you know, from the fans' point of view. He didn't seem to have any great issue with the prospect of fans, of the Liverpool fans, driving the Liverpool owners out of town. And yet, he did seem to, like, you know, he was pushing a lot of Man United buttons yesterday, Man United fans' buttons, saying that, well, really, what are they? They're actually only annoyed because they're not top dogs anymore. And they just, you know, essentially they can't take it, as opposed to any sort of real genuine rage about the European Super League and the general ownership of the Glazers and stuff like that. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But then again, Souness was also the one who I thought probably necessarily let the cat out of the bag that some flares and stuff were thrown up at us. A can of beer was thrown up at us, you know, because everyone down pitch side, they were saying, oh, this was all non-violent, you know, Neville and Carragher were saying that they didn't see any violence or anything like that. So I think it was a kind of an important point to make from the presenting team there, that actually we had a can of beer and a flare thrown up, and Souness seemed to be more rattled by that than some of his fellow colleagues. Roy Keane didn't, yeah.
Well, he was. I mean, just by the way, he kept returning to this image of this can of beer flying through the air with potentially lethal force. And I was immediately reminded of the famous President Trump speech on a similar subject.
And then they have cans of soup. Soup. And they throw the cans of soup. That's better than a brick, because you can't throw a brick. It's too heavy. But a can of soup, you can really put some power into that, right?
Yes, sir.
And then when they get caught, they say, no, this is soup for my family. It's incredible. And you have people coming over with bags of soup, big bags of soup. It's the perfect size. It's like made perfect. Soup.
Soup.
Yeah. Bags of soup. Man, a bag of cans is suddenly cast as a much more, in a much more sinister light, you know, once you started to think about the missile potential of these things. I mean, I don't know if you'd go for like a half liter can or a 330 mil can. Probably 330 mil sort of fits more snugly in the hand, right? Well, look, you shouldn't have that stuff in the stadium.
It depends on how mobile your target is.
Well, a friend of mine once I think it was his brother who ended up getting had a, you know, the plastic bottles of Coke, like the Contour bottles, is that what they're called? Of Coke.
Yes.
They were among the away supporters at a Shamrock Rovers game against a rival club who shall remain nameless.
Rats.
No, not that club, actually. Yeah. A club from outside. Outside Dublin. A big Shamrock Rovers rival from outside Dublin is all I'm giving you, Ken. Dundalk, Ken. They're at a Dundalk game. And there was a bit of stuff going on. And anyway, a bottle came flying over. And I think the story was my friend ducked. Instinctively just ducked down. But then the bottle caught his little brother unawares, who was standing directly behind him, and caught him. Not that funny, quite sore. But anyway, no serious damage done, thankfully, that day. The friend
will remain nameless. Yeah, well, that's good. It's good to know that there's no serious damage. Yeah.
And, you know, maybe in time we'll all start getting our soup in contour bottles rather than in cans.
Someone had emailed us to say... I'm giving away a lot. It's David Patterson. The subject line of his email says, "Neville is Trump." They say, "Hello." "Hello, I cannot be the only one to notice the startling similarities between the stolen election and Trump's rhetoric thereafter leading to violence at the Capitol, and Sky's own Gary Neville whipping up Man United fans with talk of the ESL's attempted murder of English football." Actually, you're not, because somebody was talking to me yesterday and said, "Oh my God, have you seen Neville's pre-match speech on Sky?" And I was like, "No, I haven't. I hadn't switched it on at that stage." And he started saying, "Yeah, all of us today do not want to see our club stolen by the Glazers. That's what they've done. That's what they're doing. We'll never give up. We'll never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. Our club's had enough. We won't take it anymore. And that's what this is all about. And to use a favorite term all of you people really came up with, we will stop the steal." And it was only when he said, "We will stop the steal," I said, "Hang on, Gary Neville said, we will stop." Gary Neville used the phrase, "stop the steal." And it was only at this point that it was revealed to me, no, that's not what I was in fact listening to. Listening to the rally speech with some little change. Trump wasn't talking about the Glazer family. But what I thought, actually, watching Neville, because he went on to sort of talk about how United had sort of slipped into ruin, and like how the stadium was rotten and everything was ramshackle, and you know, they're not spending money in this club, and you can see it sort of rusting and decaying, you know, and they actually can't afford to own this club, was sort of the thrust of what he was saying. And he came out basically and said, it's time to go, Glazers. He said, "The Glazer family are struggling to meet the financial requirements. The fans are saying enough is enough. My view on it, quite simply, is they're going to make a fortune if they sell this football club. And if they're to put it up for sale now, I think the time would be right and it would be the honorable thing to do." And the person I thought of wasn't Donald Trump. It was this guy.
"Listen, no. I want you to give me your solemn oath that you leave Carrickthorne first thing in the morning and never set foot here again. Be a good Yank. Turn around. Go home."
"I hope you realize you're breaking the law." "What's so funny?"
"Law."
"Yeah."
"This is the law."
That's a Bill McCabe there. And I will just point out to those of you who don't have the benefit of watching that amazing scene, that as he says, "This is the law," he's shaking the big stick that he's holding in his hand. It's that big stick. But of course, Tom Berenger's mistake is to be standing right in front of him.
He underestimated that big stick, didn't he, Ken, with fatal consequences?
Well, all I'm saying is if he'd been getting his lawyers to send telegrams from New York, things might have played out a little bit differently. But unfortunately, he wanted to go there and be on the land himself. And that was where he made his mistake. I do think that film essentially is just completely what's happening here, by the way. That film is essentially the whole story of this Man United.
Well, Berenger at least had cash, to be fair, though. I mean, he was at least buying it off the widow with actual money that he
had
himself.
Collateral? Did he have collateral?
No, he had cash. He didn't need any collateral.
Did he have collateral?
I mean, he didn't go to the widow and say, you know, this is a leveraged buyout of your delightful field. I mean, you could see why the Bull McCabe would get upset at that. At the end of the day, it's a free market bull, you know. If you've got the cash, the widow will sell to you. And if not, you know, get in line.
Is it though? Is it a free market? Or are there some other things to be considered here as well?
Some other field.
That's what that movie's all about.
Some other field.
It's one of
it's the role I was born to play. I really
it's was. On it's on YouTube, I should say.
The film is almost, the
film's all there. 1990, The Field, John Cochran or something like that. It's called. I don't know if it should be, but if you know, maybe it's on Netflix as well. If people have Netflix. But anyone who wants to understand what's going on at Man United, I suggest watch The Field 1990, starring Richard Harris, Dom Berenger, and of course, what's
Sean
his name?
Penn.
Sean Bean.
Sean Bean. Sean Penn.
Sean Bean. Sean Hurt.
Sean Penn's Brenda greatest Fricker. Role is definitely that one where he played a Sheffield United striker.
Yeah, he was good in that.
That movie could have been pretty good with Sean Penn in it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think this is the best football movie that Sean Bean has been involved in. The Field, 1990. Worth a look.
For fuck's sake.
We need to get back to facts here because there seems to be a bit of emotion creeping in. What you just said really isn't true.
Well, no. No, what I said. I'm not saying.
I don't know what you're saying, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean, all I
make this point.
If you found someone on the street.
You already interviewed me.
He's a goat, he's a god, he's a man, he's a guru.
You cheeky bastard.
You're one microscopic cog in his catastrophic plan, designed and directed by his red right hand.
I've heard.
Let me finish.
What happened to Chelsea?
For fuck's sake.
Well, this is going splendidly, everybody.
Put the cameras up if you want. Let's have a chat. Everybody would think that the appointment of Jose Mourinho would have been a great appointment for Manchester United to win trophies. That they would win trophies under Jose Mourinho.
Well, I don't think everybody would have thought that, but I think somebody who didn't know a lot about football would have thought that.
What, the Manchester United? Jose Mourinho?
Yeah.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
Jonathan Wilson is ready to talk about the scenes yesterday, and Mark Critchley witnessed some of what went on for The Independent. Mark, we'll start with you. You were in and around Old Trafford, and I think more specifically at the Lowry Hotel, where fans were protesting. So tell us, what did you see?
Well, I headed down. I only live around like 2 minutes away from the Lowry, so I was going to walk to the match yesterday just because of all the disruption. I thought, nice leisurely stroll, and then saw what was happening at the Lowry just down the road, went there. And I mean, it didn't look that spectacularly impressive from like about 200, 300 people stood in the middle of the road, blocking Chapel Street in Salford. But they'd lined up the traffic all the way back down the street, and they blocked off what is basically the only route that the United coach could get through, the only one that's big enough to carry them from the Lowry Hotel to Old Trafford for the games. You know, I wouldn't say, from what I saw there, there wasn't a lot happening. It was really just a standoff with police. There was singing, chanting, drinking, a few flares being lit, stuff like that. It was in no way really as dramatic as the scenes that you saw at Old Trafford, but it was probably a little bit more important because fundamentally it just made the chances of playing a game impossible. And you felt from being in that crowd that there was a genuine sense of almost defiance about it, that they simply were not moving. So after hanging around there a bit, I had a look around, managed to find a little route that was that you could get through to get to the front of the Lowry, come off the road that was leading to it and get to the front of it. And there you had the two coaches. You had a few more fans congregated outside singing, chanting. And you had like various players up on like the third or fourth floor window, like looking down and just trapped inside, bored, stuck, having nothing to do. So Brandon Williams.
Were both the teams in the same hotel?
No, I don't think so. I think Liverpool were staying at one that was off Oxford Road. I could see Brandon Williams. I think Marcus Rashford was there as well. There was a couple of others that other people saw. They were just like basically hanging out the window on their phones, recording some of the stuff sometimes. You know, they were there for about 2 or 3 hours in the end. So like they had a lot of time to kill. But that was it. And it was, like I say, it was a standoff. There wasn't a great deal happening, but, and in the end I thought, well, I can afford to like get out of here and get to Old Trafford. And at Old Trafford, I wasn't at the forecourt as such. I was at the staff entrance around where the coaches would actually come in, because that's where the media get in as well. So I was around there, and yeah, there was another much smaller group of supporters there who were basically manning the gate. They were chatting to a few of them, they kind of described themselves as definitely less militant than some of the ones that would be at the Lowry. I think that was a kind of protest where the real hardcore had gone to make sure the game didn't go ahead. But they were, you know, they were checking cars that came in. They were asking taxi drivers in blacked out people carriers to open the back door to see who was inside, whether it was Ed Woodward or one of the, you know, any kind of official, that sort of thing. Yeah. And we hung around there basically waiting to see if the game would go ahead until we got it postponed, until it was postponed. And that was it. Yeah. And that was the end of the day and people dispersed then finally. I thought it was interesting. Like I was chatting to a couple of them just at the end there. Once it was over and the confirmation came through. And even then, you know, remember, this isn't necessarily the more kind of hardcore militant ones, but even they were saying things like, is this just a smokescreen? Is this just a ruse that are the club going to say it's off? And then suddenly the coaches will come out and they'll play the game and none of you journalists will be inside and we'll all be, you know, it'll all gone ahead anyway. And we've been tricked by the club that we support or whatever. But, and I think, like I put in my piece, I think that just shows the level of distrust and mistrust that there is. Joe Glazer spoke about rebuilding that trust. I don't think it's ever been there, and you could see that in basically every interaction, every conversation that you had with the fans that were out yesterday.
I mean, you are a veteran of urban warfare. you were famously arrested at an EDL march by the police. So
wait a minute, an anti-EDL march. I think we should definitely clarify that point before we go into
it. Sorry, yeah. It was an anti.
It was anti-BMP, anti-BMP. To be fair, not EDL. It was anti-BMP. Yeah.
So what happened on that occasion? I was just wondering because to get a handle on you have you're known to the police.
I am. My fingerprints are on the national database or whatever. I think. Yeah. But what happened was I went to protest against the BMP were having a festival in Codner, which is a town in Derbyshire. I think I'd never been there before. I went with some mates. Was quite involved at the time. This was around 2009, I think. Kind of got caught up in the crowd. We kind of went past a protest barrier or something. That was the charge that they did you on. There was a certain line that you weren't supposed to cross, but everybody crossed it. And I seem to remember, like, I was with her. There was a girl with me that I didn't really know, but she'd come with us on the coach, and she was getting hit by the police. I'm going to say, make myself sound very noble here. She was getting hit by the police. So I kind of turned my back to I was on the front line right next to the police, and I turned my back to them to kind of stop her from being hit by the batons. And then the next thing I heard was, he's coming through. And so I got lifted, carried through, slammed into the pavement. That was good fun. And then carried off in a police van. Spent the rest of the day in a cell, and then was released on bail. Started my first day at university on bail. Charges got dropped eventually. The biggest mistake that I made was wearing, ironically, an England shirt, because I thought, this will be funny.
Well, these days...
These days you will get locked up and arrested just for wearing an England shirt, and in those days as well. And so I wore this England shirt as some kind of ironic joke that we were protesting against the BNP, and I was wearing an England shirt, and this then got plastered all over ITV News. My mum and dad saw, the first my mum and dad heard of it was seeing it on the Daily Mail website. Was me in an England shirt. They went upstairs to check whether the clothes that I was wearing weren't in the wardrobe, and they weren't, so they knew it was me.
The reason that I wanted to know.
The only other thing is that a few months later, because there was footage of this person being led away in an England shirt at what was a BNP related protest, I got featured in the introduction of a BBC Three documentary called Young, White and Angry. that the clip which is there. So yeah, and but for anyone doubting the authenticity, I was on. Also, there was a Nazi guy who lived in our town, and he put all my Facebook details on Red Watch, which was something that was like a website that was used to target left wing protesters, and you know, I was called like communist scum and stuff like that. It was a learning experience.
All angles.
Yeah, there you go. That's all of it.
So how would you have gauged, how did you gauge then the attitude of the protesters and of the police? I mean, you've dealt with these people before, you know what they're like. Did you feel that this situation was ugly or had the potential to become so?
So I, like I say, I wasn't at the forecourt, which seems to be the part where it really kind of kicked off between the fans and the police. At the Lowry, I was surprised maybe that the police didn't move in and try to disperse them, because that was the only way that I saw them getting the game to go ahead. But like I say, it was just the standoff, and to the point where after a while I thought, well, nothing's really going to happen here, because I can tell unless the police move in, these lads aren't going to move. They're staying here. They're making sure until they hear that the game gets called off, they aren't going anywhere. You know, there was a bit of tension in the air because of that, but it wasn't, I really don't think there was any kind of even the kind of petty vandalism or little pockets of violence that you saw at Old Trafford. There was none of that at the Lowry. And then, like I say, at the other end where I was at Old Trafford, it was very quiet. It was just like a much smaller group and security guards. Not really. There was some police presence at first, but they all moved around to the forecourt where it was all properly kicking off. So it didn't feel to me at any point like it could really, it was a powder keg or anything like that. It didn't feel like things were about to explode, but then I wasn't at the point where things, you know, there was some incidents with police, and there was a few fights or whatever, or the pitch invasion. From where I was standing, it honestly felt fairly peaceful, and you know, as if it was going to go off without much trouble.
Jonathan, the supporters around Old Trafford, around the hotel yesterday, might say they were there to protest the Glazer ownership, which has been deeply unpopular ever since, even before it was a reality. They might talk about the greed of their own owners and everybody else involved in the European Super League, but really, it's about not being successful anymore, isn't it? They're not top dogs anymore, and they just can't take it. I mean, that's essentially what Graeme Souness said on television yesterday. What do you make of that thesis?
Well, I mean, I suspect if they were winning the Champions League every season, the anger would not be as great as it is. But I think that does slightly miss the point. I mean, yeah, we're not seeing these demonstrations at City, are we? And there's a reason for that. And I guess the nature of the takeovers is different. There's far less sense that Sheikh Mansour is, you know, is sort of leeching on the club in the very direct way that the Glazers are. That, you know, they're taking the dividend payments every year. And that even the nature of the takeover, the fact that it's leveraged, means it's costing the club tens of millions of pounds every year in interest repayments, which, you know, could be better spent. Now, you know, United have spent a lot of money on players. I think net spend is the second most in Europe over the past decade. But if you go to Old Trafford, you see it's a pretty shabby place. And you know, in terms of supporter experience, I think for a club of its magnitude, it's not great compared to their peers in Europe. So the lack of success, I think that does make it worse. But yeah, you know, this is a week in which United could get to a Europa League final, in which they're almost certainly going to be second in the league. So it's not a terrible situation from that point of view. It's not entirely driven by affairs on the pitch. But it seems to me that there's a whole series of layers here. So there's the Glazer ownership, which is obviously at United where the focus of a dissent is going to be. There's then the next tier, which is sort of a general sort of intangible sense of football's being taken away from we the people. But then below that, there's a kind of much, much sort of broader thing. And I was sort of thinking about this morning that it does sort of feel as though Britain is, I mean, Mark used the word powder keg and suggesting that it didn't quite feel like that. But I do wonder if the circumstances are there that this summer you could see a whole series of outbreaks of civil disobedience, not just related to football, but the fact that there is all this pent-up energy, that people have been locked up for a year. I think there's these two very odd competing narratives in the press about the pandemic and the economic impact of the pandemic, that on the one hand, you've got people who have really struggled to live through it, who've either lost jobs or seen wages reduce significantly. Although the economic data last week was pretty good, I still think people expect significant unemployment in the coming months. And yet, on the other hand, you've got these stories of people who've saved loads of money during the pandemic and suddenly are ready to spend.
Well, isn't that just the same story, apart from, you know, some people have have done well. Some people have got, you know, some people not, and it's a story of widening inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you do get, I think, an analogous situation. Obviously, the parallels aren't direct, but it is an analogous situation to the early 80s when you had that sense of society dividing into two very distinct groups. And that then led, you know, what in those days we called the inner cities. And it led to, you know, riots in Brixton and Toxteth and Handsworth and Broadwater Farm and wherever. And I do wonder if we're moving towards another summer of that kind of thing. Because, you know, we've already seen, again, for very different reasons, we saw the protests in Bristol, particularly, although dotted elsewhere as well, over the policing bill. And also the fact that, you know, the police came out with some extraordinary statements on the first night of that, suggesting they'd been incredibly violent, which are then retracted, which I think further undermines faith in the police. Obviously, more very, very different reasons, but violence in Belfast, and you see that, you know, that's also kind of feeding into this narrative of sort of everything sort of bubbling in a very uneasy, uncertain way. And the truth is, going out on the street, protest are one of the very few things you're actually allowed to do at the minute, you know, given the restrictions. So I think the next 2 or 3 months, there could be quite a lot of different outbreaks, not just related to football.
Yeah. Mark, you had a line in your piece about how Man United fans were welcoming Gary Neville's analysis on Sky. Someone said, well, yeah, it only took him 15 years or something like this. Which, okay, Gary Neville, he was a player when the Glazers arrived, and, you know, he hasn't really said much until now, although he's saying plenty now. But, okay, obviously there's been a big change in his outlook, but also in the fans' outlook. I mean, this is, you know, I know that Man United fans have been protesting at various points, and there's been sort of flare-ups where it's become more intense than at other times, but there's been absolutely nothing like yesterday. Like, this is the biggest game of the, you know, Premier League calendar, arguably, and it's got postponed. This is like an unprecedented event. It's really huge. And, you know, what I mean, given what Jonathan's just been saying about where, you know, where this is coming from, what's your impression of just what was animating that protest yesterday? Why did we see something so different yesterday from anything that we have seen before?
Well, look, I think everybody wants to point to the Super League, and that was certainly a trigger. But I feel like this has been a current, that's an undercurrent that's just been flowing, you know, for 16 years. And you're right that it comes in kind of waves and spurts, and you see it from time to time. I think the reason why yesterday was so much more different was simply because, maybe for a lot of the reasons that Jonathan's saying, you know, people have been locked up, people have been unable to go to the ground, they're perhaps feeling even more disconnected from the club than they have in years and years. And to be honest, they're looking at, I know Jonathan's speaking there about they could get to a Europa League final this week. I think, does a Europa League final represent success for Manchester United? Does it speak to a well-run club that's what they have to settle for, that they were knocked out of the Champions League group stage?
Well, no, I mean, I don't think so. But, like, the team is looking good at the moment, I would say, better than it has for, say, most of the last 8 years since Ferguson left. You know, things seem to be on the up in a way that they haven't been for a long time. And so I don't think it can really be argued. I mean, I wouldn't try to make a cynical argument, but, like, it's not unhappiness with the team particularly that's driving this. I just thought it was funny that people were kind of saying, oh, finally Gary Neville is, you know, has realized what's going on, when in fact there's been such a step change also in the fans, and now they've been protesting, but nothing like this.
Sure, I understand that, but I feel like I say, the supporters have always felt like this. Like, one thing that I feel like was clear from yesterday was you had your elements of the support that, like I say, perhaps those at the Lowry, some others, there are elements that are much more hardcore, that are invested in this, that have been, would have been putting a lot of planning and organisation into this. I think you also, particularly at Old Trafford, had a lot of fans that were there because maybe they're quite young fans, and they've only really ever known the Glazer ownership. They've only ever really associated the past 7 or 8 years with it, the team not being as successful as it could be. And that has almost, and that's all rolled into one, and that has created this situation where everybody comes together. And even if you're a fan in, you know, even if you're one of these fans that the Super League was trying to reach out in Asia, or, you know, across the world in America, wherever, I think there is just a consistent undercurrent of just people don't like the Glazer ownership. Maybe some people aren't entirely sure why, or maybe they've not read all the financial reports. Perhaps they don't know too much about the turnover and debt and all that's been saddled onto the club. But I feel like there is a current always that they have been bad owners for this football club. I mean, it's hard to really deny that when you consider the fact that they've paid more servicing the debt than they have on players, even though they're one of the biggest net transfer spends in Europe over the past seven
and
or eight
that was
years.
Yeah, again, that was the big Souness point, was that look, you know, whatever's happening, they're still shelling out money for players. And normally, well, you know, traditionally, that's often been what fans, the main thing fans care about. And I think that has probably changed. And maybe that's an unfair, you know.
I was so annoyed by that because, like, he's completely missing the point. Like, you don't praise the Glazers for being, like, generous owners for allowing Manchester United to spend some of the money that the club makes on players. Like, that's crazy. Like, it's totally different from what, say, Abramovich or, you know, any of these sort of sugar daddy owners do. They're not putting in their own money. They're just saying, yeah, okay, we can spend some of our turnover on players. I mean, of course. Like, but that doesn't make the Glazers generous.
Just
because they're letting United use some of the money.
Just to tease out that
football
point, though, again, you know, they could actually just take even more. You know, they could take even more dividends out. They could, you know, that, like, that's, this is the point that Souness is making, I guess. I don't know. I'm not Graham Souness, obviously. But that the... Okay, sure, they take out all their own dividends. They do this, they do that, they do the other. But they're still leaving a lot of money in there to buy players that should be good enough to win trophies, which, you know, we did think for a long time is the main thing that fans want. No?
But, I mean, if you think... Well, what do we think of as a good football owner? I think it was only since, like, the 1980s that it became standard for owners to start taking a salary from the club. They're generally thought of as benefactors. They're generally thought of as people who are there to invest. And there's been, well, the investment has been zero, basically, for the Glazers, because this is a club that has turnover of $630 million odd a year. You should be too big to fail. You know, their commercial revenues, they've been flat for a few years now, but they're still the biggest of any club in England, dwarf all the other clubs, still some $100 million more than Liverpool, who have an argument to say that they're the second biggest club in England. I guess people might argue that. And it's a club that before them was free of debt since 1931. You know, this is, I don't think it's unrealistic to for the fans to look at the last 15, 16 years and think about what the club could have achieved and how perhaps dominant it could have been if it hadn't spent so it's over £1 billion servicing debt that was forced onto them as part of this leverage takeover.
But isn't what makes most football clubs successful spending money on the best players? Like, most people agree that the teams with the best players are what wins titles and wins trophies and makes a club successful. So they still have spent that money on those players. Am I flogging a dead horse here? I mean, is this? I feel like I'm in the Dave Jones role here. Like, at one stage, Neville says, "Dave, I know you have to play devil's advocate." And he's like, "I'm not being devil's advocate. You know, I'm making a genuine point here about fans and all this kind of stuff."
So I felt sorry for Dave Jones.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about Dave earlier. Right? Tough gig for him, but I feel like I'm in that role a little bit now. Nobody wants to test that again now.
Well, I mean, like, Man United is a commercial giant. Like, it makes all this money. It's like, you know, it's been consistently for the period of the Glazer ownership one of the top three, maybe top four clubs in the world, and has been the top club in the world in terms of revenue at times during that. So it's, of course, they're going to spend money on players, and they would have spent a lot more if they hadn't also had to fund this takeover to the tune of £1 billion over 15 years. I mean, it's been such a massive resource drain on them that, like, it amazes me that anyone would still make that argument at this point in time.
But I also think that the spending on players is it's only part of a much bigger picture. And one of the reasons they've spent so much on players is because their scouting is not particularly good, that they haven't invested in the scouting department, that their data analysis isn't good enough, that the training ground isn't good enough, that the academy isn't good enough. And that if you actually invest in the infrastructure, you don't have to spend that much money. And a lot of the time, the big signings or the big wages have been paid at a cover for mistakes that they have made. Mm. So I think you've got to look in the round. And, okay, the transfers, the net spend looks impressive, but all the other stuff looks appalling. And I think, you know, Old Trafford is this incredible symbol of where the Glazer ownership is failing the club, that you go there now and it feels shabby. You know, the whole problem that... what was the issue Paul Pogba had with a tweet that was delayed, so it looked like
his Wi-Fi didn't work.
but that's true. Any journalist who's been there knows the Wi-Fi at Old Trafford is terrible. Now, it has improved, I think, over the last sort of... just before lock. Because obviously, Wi-Fi in stadiums is great now because you don't have any fans getting in the way. But even when there were fans there, I think it did improve slightly. But it was years when Old Trafford's Wi-Fi was... I mean, that's a pathetic journalist sort of how it impacts on us. But it's symptomatic of a greater whole. That the general experience of people going to the ground, and fans obviously have that going to their seats and seeing the rust on the stadium, seeing the shabby paint, looking at other grounds where you have the massive screens, or you have the fan parks outside, or you have your vegan burgers on the concourse. I don't know how popular that would be in Manchester, to be fair, but you know what I mean. That they are not getting the super club deal that, say, Arsenal fans get.
We were talking about Dave Jones, and it is a tough gig, I suppose, trying to rein in Gary Neville. And
the forthright Gary Neville. Yeah.
Well, the point that he kept, like, he did... Okay, whatever about the specifics of what he's saying, it is a fact that the debate about this whole these issues on Sky has been a lot more interesting than on the other... broadcasters. I mean, on BT and BBC, there's seldom any discussion of this kind of ownership or difficult political stuff. Why do you think that is, Jonathan?
I think partly it's Gary Neville. He is politically engaged. He does have political ideas. He is very prepared to express them. And I guess to an extent, he's able to lead the discussion because of his position at Sky. And I think, and Carragher's perfectly good at joining in as well. I guess they've got time to go into detail, which maybe other channels. I mean, I'm thinking of Match of the Day or something that they don't have that time. I don't know. Maybe it's just a slightly more mature broadcaster. I guess the fact that it sort of knows it's not going to be able to afford Super League rights, it can afford to be anti Super League. Well, maybe BT sort of was still thinking that they could maybe pick up some of the crumbs. But I would say it probably comes down to personality. It is probably Gary Neville leading it, and good for him.
Yeah, the only point at which it looked like that game might be able to be played yesterday was at around 5:15 when they'd finally expelled all the fans from the stadium area. And it was like, well, we might be able, it might be safe to play a game of football now that all the police have gotten rid of all of the fans. But do you expect, Mark, that we're going to see this again? Because, I mean, having seen this sort of stunning success of this, it's not as though the concerns of supporters have gone away. You know, I mean, everything is still the same today as it was yesterday. And old Dave Jones kept saying to Gary Neville, "We don't want to see fans storming stadiums, Gary, do we?" And he said... He eventually admitted, no, we don't. But, you know, at the same time, why wouldn't they keep doing this? What I'm saying is, really, do you expect this to continue over the next few weeks?
I mean, it's something I'm going to try and establish properly today, but I feel like you're right that none of the issues were resolved. I keep coming back to it. I think what happened at the Lowry was really important. There was a discipline to that. There was an organisation to that. It was successful ultimately as well. And it was the kind of thing that you don't tend to see from these fan protests. You know, I know all the optics of what happened at Old Trafford were really compelling, and this was just like a load of people stood in the street. But you know, usually things happen when fans protest. It's inside the ground. It's outside the ground. And if you remember back to the green and gold stuff in 2010. You know, there was that generated a lot of coverage and a lot of interest, but who really benefited from that? It was probably just the blokes who sell the scarves outside Old Trafford, and you know, it didn't hit the ownership. And one of the big things was, you know, do we take this further by going further to a boycott? That was going to be the next step. I mean, you can't boycott behind closed doors games, but you can blockade them. And I feel like that tactic yesterday, you say that it felt like it would be possible for the game to get on once they cleared the fans outside of Old Trafford, but I just couldn't see it happening without any movement at the Lowry. And it was a simple but really effective tactic. And I wouldn't be surprised if whenever this game gets rearranged, or whether it's for the Leicester game this next Wednesday, whether the same people who are, like I said, some of the more hardcore elements of it and more organised and disciplined, I think I wouldn't be surprised if they attempt to do exactly the same thing. And it didn't, I think the thing about that as well is to say, it didn't really take a lot of people. Like I said, there was about 200, 300 people there. Would they all be up for doing it again? Given that, you know, there's a lot of notice about Premier League games. It's not like they're just happy. You can just play them at the drop of a hat. They're gonna know when it's happening. They're gonna know that the United are staying there. Or, to be honest, from some of the organisations, some of the social media stuff that I saw going around yesterday, even if they changed hotel, even if they tried to switch up their plans a bit, they'd figure that out as well. They have information. They know what's happening. So I really wouldn't be surprised to see it happen again. And that's gonna obviously cause a lot of issues in terms of when you actually play these games, when we don't know when this Liverpool game is going to be played. It doesn't seem like there's a free window for it. I think yesterday I thought, well, they could just play it today, as in Monday, and that might be short notice enough to avoid any other protests. But I mean, that's not happening now, and I feel like those fans will feel empowered by what they did yesterday, and they'll feel it's easy enough to repeat again, and we definitely could see it again. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading your reporting on this, Mark, because I know that you at the beginning of this story, if I'm not mistaken, when the European Super League was announced, you found yourself in a yurt at some kind of with some friends in some kind of a nature retreat. With no Wi-Fi or signal, cut off from the world's media, and emerged blinking into a radically changed reality like Rip Van Winkle a couple of days later. And I thought, is that broadly accurate, what happened when the Super League?
Yeah, I was going on holiday in the Yorkshire Dales. I must have had like three or maybe like five. I've done this job for maybe 5 years now. I've had maybe 5 days of those where I've been completely off grid, and like European football just imploded in what, three of them, I guess. I was going in the Yorkshire Dales, and Martin Ziegler's story dropped, and I saw it, and I thought, yeah, you know, Super League, we've seen this a few times. Maybe this is a bit more serious because of the Champions League changes tomorrow. But I didn't think anything of it, and then enjoyed about it. I got some signal back on the Monday, realised it was serious. But the problem was, I was with three people who really could not give less of a shit about it. So I was kind of losing my mind at this little cafe in the Yorkshire Dales, and they were like, "Right, okay, sounds interesting, whatever." And then I was off grid again until Wednesday, and it felt like I came out of that. You know that bit in The Simpsons in one of the Treehouse of Horrors where Homer keeps going back in time and he keeps messing things up because he killed a lizard, but he eventually settles on like a reality where everything seems normal, everything seems fine, but it turns out everyone eats their breakfast with amphibian tongues. That was kind of it. It felt like everything was the same, but radically different at the same time. And I just came out of it and thought, okay, well, this is it now. Fair enough. This is
how it works. I thought it was interesting in that, because just the way that, although it turns out you did find out about it in dribs and drabs, in tiny dribs and drabs, and probably had
tiny
filling in
tiny,
a lot of what was happening with your imagination. I was just wondering how it felt to sort of see that thing kind of almost out of the blue, what the most surprising aspect of it was, as opposed to sort of watching it develop step by step, like hour by hour. But like, was there anything about it thinking back that you were particularly shocked by?
I think just the fact that it collapsed. I think it's difficult. Like I think I tweeted it last week that like I spent the past week, once I came back into civilization, I kind of realized that I needed to catch up on all this stuff, and none of it really felt real. Like I'm saying, none of it, you almost don't feel like it happened, but just the fact that it collapsed that there was so little that you hire, you know, some of the biggest PR companies in the world to do all this research into how, oh, this would be a great success. Don't worry, everyone's going to love this. And then and that it fell apart within 48 hours with, I just found the incompetence, if you like, among those 12 clubs and the cowardice for any of them to actually come forward and represent it. I know Perez has basically been the guy in the end, but it was always his project in the first place. I just thought when it came, it would be a lot more organized. It would almost be like a tidal wave that just couldn't be stopped. Whereas this was just, I don't know, it was a puddle, wasn't it? It was just a splash. It felt important. And I'm sure, like I say, I don't have a proper understanding of it because I wasn't like live scrolling everything through it. It feels like it didn't actually exist, but it didn't actually happen in my reality. But the most surprising thing was certainly just how shabby it was in the end and how easily it failed.
Well, I think we've probably all learned more about Mark Ritchley's private life than expected today. So we'll wrap it up there. Mark, Jonathan, brilliant. Thanks a million.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers, lads.
I care not one jot about his supreme talent. He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter.
Yeah, there's one other group we have to talk about who were affected by proceedings yesterday, and that is, of course, Manchester City, whose march to the title is delayed. I'm sure not for
very
long.
They're on the verge. They're very much on the verge. And I think they're going to win the league this year. 2-0. Sergio Aguero, lovely goal. What a man. What a player. What a goal. Nothing can ever match up to his 2012 goal, said Pep Guardiola. Aguero!
Was it Ian Wright in Match of the Day who said they played a clip of Pep going, oh, I just love Sergio. I love this man. I love him as a player. I love him as a man the most, you know. And Ian Wright said, if you love him so much, why don't you give him a new contract?
It's so insincere. Like, you know, I mean, it's just. Like,
do you know the question as you're asking to me?
But I find that totally ridiculous that Pep would do that.
Yeah.
You know, like, to go,
odd,
just, it's
it?
Just like, too over the top and weird. It's like, yeah, you know, Sergio, he's a great player. You know, he's a great. Like, he just goes so over the top that it almost sounds like sarcasm.
I'm so happy, believe me.
Yeah, I've never seen a player better than David Silva in small spaces. But I mean, you know, it's just like there are ways to praise these people without sounding unbelievably insincere. They are, after all, unbelievably good footballers. So I don't know how you managed to like have done it more than once with Sergio in this situation where you're trying to praise someone and it actually comes across like you're being a bit of a dick about it.
Oh, and you're amazing.
Well, in the meantime, they've got Paris Saint-Germain tomorrow night in the Champions League. We'll talk about that one on Wednesday. And on Thursday, we'll be talking about Chelsea-Real Madrid, which takes place on Wednesday evening. You probably knew those fixtures were already taking place. But there you go. Just to mark your cards. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. And thank you, Ciarán.
Thank you, Owen. And thank you, Ken.
Thanks so much for listening. That is your Bank Holiday Monday podcast today. A reminder to everybody that for the World Service members who may have missed for any reason the Andrew Trimble, Oisín McConville chat, and for you Monday Only members who want another peek, a real detailed peek at some of the great stuff that's going on behind the scenes on the World Service, that will be available to everybody later on today. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Some other field.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.